Thank you for listening to this forum podcast. Please check out our website for a rich archive of podcasts and writing from contemporary philosophers and other researchers on a wide variety of topics. The Forum is an educational charity dedicated to bringing academic philosophy to a broader audience. Please consider donating to us via our Just Giving page, which you can find on our website. Happy listening.
Well, hi everyone. My name is Peter Dennis. I teach in the philosophy department here at LSE, and it's my pleasure to introduce this event on Does the Universe Have a Purpose? There are two traditional answers to this question, which are yes and no. Yes being the traditional theist answer, which says there's a benevolent God and the purpose of the universe somehow involves us. No, it's the atheist answer, which says we're living in this meaningless, purposeless, material universe. Tim Mulgan rejects this dichotomy in his new book, Purpose in the Universe, and it's great that we've got Tim here with us tonight to discuss it with us, starting with a short précis of the book. He's Professor of Moral and Political Philosophy at the University of Auckland. And we've also got Bev Clack, who's Professor of Philosophy of Religion at Oxford Brookes University, and John Cottingham, who's Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at the University of Reading. So, Tim, perhaps you can kick us off with telling us what this book is all about.
Thanks, Peter, and thanks to everyone for coming, and thank you to the forum for inviting me. So I think my answer in my book is, does the universe have a purpose? Yes, but you won't like it, basically. So I've prepared what I'm going to write because the book is 200,000 words long and otherwise I will just go on forever. Why does the cosmos exist? Is there a purpose to the universe? Western philosophy offers two very familiar answers. Theists believe in a benevolent God, a personal creator who cares about the fate of each individual human being. The universe exists because God chose to create it, because it would be good. Atheists, on the other hand, reject all gods and all supernatural entities or explanations. The existence of the universe is ultimately just a brute fact. Science tells us how the cosmos works, but there is no reason why it exists. Theism and atheism, defined in those terms, are not the only logical possibilities. Theists posit one very particular supernatural being, while atheists reject all supernatural explanations. Other alternatives are imaginable. Why would a creator have to care about us? And why must a cosmic explanation involve any personal creator at all? Could the universe exist simply because that was good, without the intervention of a person who recognised that potential goodness? In my book, the snappily titled Purpose in the Universe, the Moral and Metaphysical Case for an Anthropocentric Purposivism, I defend one alternative to both theism and atheism, which I call an anthropocentric purposivism, or AP for short, which makes the book less long than it would be. This is the view that there is a cosmic purpose, a reason for existence, a source of transcendent objective values, but human beings are irrelevant to that purpose. Our existence is a cosmic accident. The universe is about something, but it is not about us. I call my view purposivism rather than simply theism because I want to leave open the possibility of a non-human-centered cosmic purpose without a personal God. Perhaps our belief in a personal God is just another unjustified anthropocentrism. I defend AP by borrowing arguments from both theism and atheism. So basically I wrote the book by just cutting and pasting from things that other people have said. Theist philosophers argue that we need God to explain why there is something rather than nothing, why the universe is friendly to the emergence of life, why people have religious experiences, or why moral norms are binding. Even if they all succeed, such arguments only prove that some God exists. They don't guarantee us a benevolent God. On the other side, atheists insist that the prevalence of evil, suffering, and injustice proves that this world was not created by God. Even if they succeed, these atheist arguments only rule out a benevolent God. They don't rule out non-benevolent gods. Perhaps what evil teaches us is not that God doesn't exist, but that God is not interested in us. A theme of the book is that our universe is religiously ambiguous. It's open to equally reasonable but radically different interpretations. A lot of people think theism and atheism are both credible options, and I want to say that AP is credible as well. Faced with this choice between credible options, any belief involves a leap of faith. We should be wary of self-aggrandizing or self-important leaps, of comforting conclusions that tell us either that we matter or that nothing does. AP is the most unsettling option. We don't matter, but something else does. So an obvious challenge for this view is an existential or a marketing challenge. Why would anyone want to believe this, or how would it change your life if you did? Theism promises a reciprocal relationship with a personal God. AP cannot deliver this. Atheism promises a universe where we create our own values. AP cannot deliver that either. But AP does have moral resources that atheism lacks. If we came to believe in AP, we could still study, contemplate, or explore whatever it is that truly matters in the universe, which might be structure or beauty or mathematical elegance or life itself. We could then try to mirror the cosmic values in our own lives. So according to AP, we don't matter to the universe, but it might still matter to us.
Thanks very much, Tim, for that great précis. I want to pick up on something that you said, which is that the universe is religiously ambiguous. That's to say that given the evidence that we have, it would be reasonable to conclude that God exists, that he doesn't exist, or thirdly, alternatively, this other suggestion, AP, which I practiced saying lots of times before I came, an anthropocentric purposivism. There you go, I've got it right. John, can we start with you? Do you agree, for a start, that our universe is religiously ambiguous?
I do, in the sense that I think it's reasonable that two equally sensible and sensitive people could take very different views looking out at the cosmos we inhabit. And that's one thing I like about Tim's approach. I think a lot of the debates between atheism and theism have become very confrontational, and it's very welcome to hear that two equally reasonable people could take different views. I'm not sure about... I think actually the idea of evidence, you know, that we confront the evidence, and is itself rather problematic, because some of the evidence for theism, the theistic view which I support, I think may not be, as it were, neutral. They're lying on the table waiting to be collected and observed. It may require certain changes in the subject to become manifest. In particular on, and this is where I curiously agree with Tim, I think that we humans morally respond to certain objective values. We, as it were, hear the call of normativity. We hear authoritative calls to goodness, to justice, to benevolence, even though we often don't follow them. So I think we're agreed on this, that there must be something in reality that calls forth these responses. But then it's just the last... So I think, in a way, Tim's a would-be theist. But it's just the last step that I don't get, really. He says, well, there is something in the universe which is metaphysically grounds this value which we respond to, but it's kind of not interested in us. It has nothing much to do with us. And that's the final step in the argument I find so puzzling. We're responding to a call which is not addressed to us. I find that weird, but anyway.
Just... Well, there'll be plenty of occasion to get into that as we go on. Let's remain for now with this question of whether the universe is religiously ambiguous. John, you said you agreed with that. Bev, would you complete the agreement, at least on that point?
I was sitting there listening to John, actually, and I think as somebody who's very interested in alternative religious perspectives beyond that kind of theism-atheism divide, which, again, I was very happy with Tim's attempt to break that kind of duality, I suppose. I was trying to think, as Tim was talking, about what it is that the universe elicits from us. You know, is there something about the development of a perspective that's the thing that we're getting at when we think about religion? You know, what is religion fundamentally about? Is it something to do with how we attempt to make connections outside of ourselves with something, be it others, be it the universe, be it God, whatever we mean by God. And so I was trying to work out quite where I would fit on that spectrum, because one of the things I very much liked in what Tim was doing in the book was that he was offering quite an austere approach to religion. Perhaps religion's the wrong word. I don't know whether it might be worth saying something about where you think religion fits in this, but I liked the idea that it wasn't about me believing something in order to get something, you know, be it kind of life after death or some kind of reward in this life or anything like that. It was something about a commitment that I thought was really powerful in how you develop your argument, and I don't know whether religion is something that would fit in with your kind of approach there. I don't know.
I mean, it does in various ways. So there isn't, as far as I can tell, there isn't a mainstream religion which you could describe as being a version of AP. There are strands within a lot of religious traditions, and the tradition that I'm most familiar with is Christianity. There are strands within that religious tradition which tend towards the direction of AP. Right? So there are themes of emphasising the otherness of God, or the respect in which our relationship with God is asymmetrical. Mm-hmm. So I think there might be, for any extent, theist religion, a lot of things would have to go if you embraced AP. So in particular, in the case of Christianity, something like the incarnation is very hard to make sense of on the AP view, because that's not a... Becoming a human being is not something you would do if you were an AP God. But I think there is certainly a place on this view for a lot of attitudes that people think of as religious. And one of the things that I think about in terms of religious ambiguity is that I come to the religious ambiguity from moral philosophy, and the kind of ambiguity that I'm particularly interested in is this ambiguity about different views of what values are and how we respond to values. And there are, within moral philosophy, there's a sort of tradition that value is essentially something that's human, that's a human contract or a human construct, or it's something that we in some sense invent, or it's part of our sociology or something. And then there's another tradition where you say the values are out there in the world and we are called to respond to them. And it does seem to me that there are people in moral philosophy, in the consequentialist utilitarian tradition, who talk like this about value. They talk about value as if it's out there objectively, transcendently in the world. But if you accuse them of being religious, they would be horrified. Right? They think, no, we're secularists, but we have this attitude to the value that's out there, which is, I think, like something that is in religion. And so, yeah.
Now, I agree. It's a very odd feature of our philosophical culture that the majority of philosophers are now objectivists about value. So they think there's something more to value than just personal preferences or desires. But then if you ask them, well, what grounds that value? What is it in the nature of the cosmos that makes these values real and makes them exert some power on us? Then I think they haven't got a satisfactory answer, because they think, they take the atheist view, as you said, that the universe is just a flux of conditions that arise, and a purely impersonal flux of conditions that arise and pass away, with nothing in it to support the idea of value. So that, your critique of materialist atheism, I think, is very persuasive. But having got that far, it's puzzling to me why you don't just go all the way down the road to theism.
Is it the personal, the idea of the personal God that is the fundamental sticking point? Because it strikes me that there are positions of people like, I mean, the person that I've always really enjoyed reading and use a lot in my own work is Stuart Sutherland, for grounding again that idea of objective value in the way the universe is. There's just something about the way the universe is, and that theism has traditionally provided a set of tools for unpacking that kind of approach, but that Sutherland similarly would ditch the idea of a personal God. He'd stick with, you know, there's being something about the way the world is, and that's the intimation perhaps of whatever the divine might be.
So the idea of there being a personal God is something I want to be officially agnostic about in the book. So I think the reason I call it an anthropocentric purposivism is to leave open the possibility that it might be a God or it might not be. So the real sticking point is God caring for us, right? Where that means being interested in the fate or the life of each individual human being. And again, part of the motivation for that comes again from the moral philosophy and from the tradition of moral philosophy that I'm sort of immersed in, which is this utilitarian tradition where suffering is a thing that's hugely important for human beings, and that caring for somebody means not wanting them to suffer. And so part of what I'm wanting to reconcile is the idea of there being objective values with the idea that it is very hard from a utilitarian perspective to believe there's a God who cares for us, because the problem of evil is very pressing for utilitarians, because they don't attach as much value to freedom, and particularly to the sort of incompatibilist transcendent freedom that you need in order to run most of the theist responses to the problem of evil. So I'm sort of caught in these two things of wanting to say that there are objective transcendent values that explain why the cosmos exists and that somehow call to us, but also that if we stick with the theist metaphor, because that's the easiest one to talk about, the person who created this universe in response to those values did not do so out of concern for us or to make it a place that we would flourish, and doesn't care whether we flourish. So that is obviously a problem. And one of the ways I try and resolve it is to say, well, there could be a single set of transcendent objective values, but there are different appropriate ways to respond to those values depending on who you are and depending on what kind of being you are. And the appropriate way for God to respond to those values is to see things at a level of abstraction or a level of size or a level of complexity where the lives of individual human beings just don't figure. Right? So there might be a scale of what the objective values are, and God looks at the different possible worlds and just sees the pattern,
yeah,
or just sees the emergence of life. When we look at the same values from our very limited, very little perspective, it might be appropriate for us to care about sort of very slight details or slight resemblances to those values that don't matter to God.
And many traditional theists say that there may be reasons for the suffering, but we can't fathom them. But actually, of course, this is a very ancient objection to belief in God, the amount of suffering beneath in a benevolent God, the amount of suffering in the world. But it's a curious point. It's not as if the believer thinks the world is a happy, jolly place, and then someone comes along and says, oh, wait a minute, there's a lot of suffering around. I mean, that's just not the way it works. On the contrary, if you look at the way religion actually operates, you find an acute awareness of suffering right at the center of religious consciousness. So, for example, in the Bible, the Jewish people were acutely aware of the undeserved suffering that comes upon human beings. And they were the very people who reflected on the loving kindness of God. So there's a certain distance, I think, this is one of my problems with the book, from religion as it actually operates in the lives of those who are religious, and a certain distance from the actual religious tradition. It's almost as if the arguments are purely academic, the amounts of suffering, the question of destinations or purposes, but without a consideration of the form of life, what it means to be religious, and how that relates to our well-being and the suffering that we undergo as human beings. So it's a kind of over-academicization, I think, that worries me about the way some of the issues are approached here.
I think that's partly because there are lots of different questions you can ask about evil and suffering. And if you are a theist and you're committed to theism, then in a way you're doing a different kind of project when you talk about evil. You're saying, how can we make sense of suffering in our lives? How can we call on God or draw on God or make sense of this in the context of believing in theism? Whereas my perspective in the book is sort of to take the standpoint of someone who's genuinely agnostic between the different positions and just to say, well, you could be persuaded by the arguments that there are objective values, but still think that the best explanation for the existence of evil is going to be either that there isn't a God or that God doesn't care about us. And it does seem to me that that's at least a position that makes sense. And that the things that drive you to believe in the values in the first place might not be... can come apart from the different moves that the theist has to make to make sense of evil. And also I'd say, it is academic and philosophical because it's a piece of academic philosophy, I suppose, but there are metaphysical assumptions that even, as lived religion often needs to help itself to. Mm. So controversial beliefs about freedom, controversial beliefs about life after death, which one of the advantages, I think, of my view is that if you can't bring yourself to believe that human beings survive death, then it is very hard to deal coherently with the existence of evil and to combine that with theism. So one of the advantages of my view is that you can believe in God and purpose and value without believing in an afterlife.
So can I just quickly pick on just one? So God is, well, actually you weren't clear on whether he's a person or not, but he's a supernatural entity who's deeply implicated in value, in the good, but just doesn't care about the good in some parts of the cosmos. So it's a perfect being who ignores... So perhaps I thought there are lots of questions there, but is this a person in the fact to begin with?
So that's one of the things I want to leave open, whether it's a person or not. And I am open to the possibility that it might be that the most consistent version of my view is one where you deny that God is a person. And part of the reason for that is that thinking that God is a person does pushes you in the direction of thinking that God will care about other persons. So, and if you're tempted by that, then the AP response is to say, well, then what we have to give up is the idea that God is a person.
But then purposes without a person.
Yeah. That is my...
And I think that's... I wonder...
In some sense.
Would it be possible for you to clarify that notion of purpose? Because that was the bit that I really found I struggled with. And perhaps it's coming out quite clearly in that discussion of if God is a person or God has a purpose. There's an assumption that to have purposes you have to be an agent. And I suppose I'd just like to know a little bit more about what you mean by purpose.
Right, yeah, so purpose is not a word that I'm entirely happy with, even though it's in the title of the book and it's in the name of the view. So one way to illustrate it is to say there's theism and there's atheism, and I want my view to be compatible with a certain kind of theism, but not to be committed to any kind of theism, but to be consistent with some other view which isn't really atheism, but isn't theism either. And purposivism is the word that I use for the disjunction of either theism in the general sense of believing in a god, or this other possibility where there are transcendent objective values which explain the existence of the universe. And therefore, and so that's the sense in which I tend to mean purpose. So maybe I could say a few things, to make that clearer, maybe, about what an alternative view might look like, I think. So one way into this is there's a problem that theists have, people who believe in God. So somebody says, why does the universe exist? The universe exists because it was created by God. And there's always going to be somebody in Sunday school who says, well, who created God? Or where did God come from? And theists, there are various sort of intermediate responses you can make. You can say, well, God wasn't created because God has always existed. But then you can still ask, well, why does this God who has always existed exist? And a lot of theists think that's a sensible question, because they also think if it turned out that the physical universe had always existed, we could still ask why there was the physical universe always existing, in which at this point we're having this conversation, as opposed to a physical universe that's always existed that's only got marshmallow eating dragons or some other, whatever other possible thing it might be. So there's still something to be explained, even if the thing is eternal. Then people say, well, God exists because God's existence is somehow necessary. But again, we can imagine, and philosophers do this all the time, a lot of very different beings whose existence would have been necessary, and we can still say, why is this the God who actually necessarily eternally exists? And at that point, a lot of theists will say, God exists because God is the most perfect imaginable being. Or God exists because it is good that God exists. And then at that point, there are people who come in and say, well, there's a dilemma for the theist here. Either that kind of explanatory story makes sense, where you say, this thing exists because it is the most perfect thing, or this thing exists because it is good that it exists. Either that's an intelligible story, or it's not. if it's not an intelligible story, then the theist doesn't have a complete explanation of the universe, because they've just replaced the inexplicable universe with the inexplicable God. And that's, it's not clear that that's an improvement. On the other hand, if this kind of story, this familiar theist, it exists because it's a good story, if that works, then there's a simpler explanation where you could just cut out the middle person. And you say, forget about God, why does the universe exist? The universe exists because it is good that it exists. And so this is a view which is attracting more attention. So various philosophers, John Leslie and Derek Parfit and Nicholas Rescher, among others, have sort of toyed with this view. It's sometimes called axiarchism. It's sometimes called axiogenesis. So I could have called my view an anthropocentric axiarchism, but that would have been... I would have sold even fewer copies, I think. But often it's just called Platonism, because this is a view that, in various versions, goes back to Plato and runs through the history of Western philosophy, that out of all the possibilities that could have been actualized, one of them is actualized, and... if the one that is actualized is particularly remarkable or particularly valuable or particularly special in some objective way, then it doesn't seem satisfactory or adequate to say, well, that's just the way it is. It just happened to be this possibility. Things had to be some way. They happened to be this way. That doesn't satisfy people, because the universe seems to be particularly remarkable and so on. So I think that's at least a view that's worth exploring and a view that might make sense. And it gives you something like a purpose that isn't somebody's purpose. And if I can just say one more thing. I think one of the real objections that people have to the axiarchist, axiogenesis, Platonist kind of story, apart from the idea of whether it makes sense and how it works, is that it can't possibly be true that the universe exists because it's good, because it's not that good. And there are lots of unsatisfactory features of it. There's suffering and injustice and all those sorts of things. So we need to bring in God to explain why there is such an imperfect universe. So that's a problem that a lot of axiarchists face. But my AP view just solves those problems, and you can say, well, maybe the answer is that, you know, the universe is not only particularly good or particularly special, it is the best possible universe. And if you then say, well, it doesn't look very good from the perspective of human beings, then the answer might be that's the wrong perspective. You know, the best explanation is there is another perspective from which this is the best possible world. So that's the kind of I don't know if that makes it clearer or less clear. Or...
No. not to me. Well, at least I think you're starting in the right place with goodness, with morality, with meaning, with value. In my own view, religion isn't about explanatory hypotheses, how the universe exists. It's not like science. It's not an attempt to search for explanations. It's an attempt to find meaning and value in our lives. As far as I can see from what you've just said, you think somehow there's a movement, a drive in things towards the good. But so that kind of teleology, sort of movement towards the good, would, I think, isn't really the right kind of teleology. It's not the right kind of direction, because the way we actually go, as I think you can see, things are often quite a mess. We often don't pursue the good. The teleology that's at work is a normative teleology, it seems to me. That's to say, it's a matter of where we ought to be going. This gets back to what I was talking about, the normative call, the call to goodness. So it's not a matter of how the universe is moving or what the purposes or goals of it are, if that makes sense. It's more a matter of the governing value towards which we ought to orient ourselves, even though we don't. And that takes us right back to the idea of a personal God. Incidentally, I still don't understand how you can have purposes without persons, but that's, in a way, you've answered that by saying it's not really a purpose, it's a tendency. Things tend to exist because they're good, or God at least tends to exist because he's good. But anyway, I think it becomes pretty baroque at that point if we don't hang on to this, the idea of meaning and value at the center of what it is to be religious, the idea of objective meaning and value. And then it's not that we are actually following that, but that we ought to. It's what I call a normative teleology.
In lots of ways, I think there's a lot of similarity between probably how we think about religion and what religion might be about. Perhaps it is, because I struggle with this idea of purpose. I struggle with it because I think it, for me, always resonates with progressive ideas, that there's something about the inevitability of that. And I don't actually see why a religious perspective needs to hold to an inevitability about things. I think it might be quite possible to think in terms of there being a divine horizon, or, you know, we're trying to show. And that's why I loved all the stuff where you were talking about morality and how we live well, and, you know, that seemed to me to start to get more at that kind of approach, that it's not, because purpose just troubles me. It troubles me because it sounds too linear. And I just struggled with that, and I wasn't entirely sure how that actually is played out in the religious life, I suppose, if I'm honest. I couldn't really see how that notion would really make that much sense for what people think they're doing when they adopt religious positions, including myself, I should say. So.
Right. Yeah, so one respect in which purpose is not the best word is that it has this connotation of sort of progressiveness, or the universe moving towards something, or things inevitably getting better. And the axiarchic story, certainly as I understand it, doesn't need to have any element of that. Right? So it's not that the universe has a goal or an end that it's moving towards. It's rather that sort of timelessly the reason why the universe exists is because this is a good kind of universe to have, right? Or there are certain values according to which this is a particularly good universe, or possibly, you know, at the extreme, the best possible universe. And so it's not necessarily, especially if you've got a universe in which there's indeterminism or whatever, it doesn't necessarily mean that every single thing that happens in the universe is directly caused by those values, or that everything in the universe infallibly responds to those values. Right? So it might be that there's still a gap between particular things and particular beings in the universe and the very abstract transcendent values that explain why there's this kind of universe rather than some other kind of universe. And so there's still going to be something for us to strive to, or for us to move towards, because if we can figure out what those transcendent values are, then we could say, well, we want to live our lives in a way that is more in harmony with, or shows more understanding with, or is a better approximation of, or a better resemblance to those cosmic values, whatever they might turn out to be.
I'm going to ask you to pause here because we want to take some questions from our audience, who I'm sure are also burning to ask a question. If you've got a question, please put your hand up and I'll make sure the microphone comes to you. There's one straight away at the front, but if you could just keep your hands up and I'll try to identify you. There's one. It was right here. Yeah. Okay.
Two questions. The first one is very quick. Do you have any maths in your book? Second question is maths or physics. Second question, to what extent should all these existential questions impact our everyday life and the way we want to live?
Thank you. So the answer to the first question is sort of yes and no, I suppose. So I don't... I mean, I have a couple of chapters where I talk about physics and I talk about maths. So, but I don't... It doesn't have maths in the sense of having lots of symbols and equations and things like that. So one question... One reason for having mathematics is that mathematical facts are another philosophically very interesting example of a kind of fact that's very hard to fit into a purely physicalist, naturalist, materialist view of the world. So a lot of people are tempted by the thought that our knowledge of moral facts or cosmic values might be similar to our knowledge of mathematical facts. And the physics that appears in the book is particularly to do with teleological arguments for the existence of God, and especially fine-tuning arguments. So arguments that the universe appears to be very fine-tuned to enable it to be a place where life can emerge naturally through evolutionary processes. So there are various cosmic constants which, if they'd been very slightly different, the universe wouldn't have been able to give rise to life. And there's a familiar kind of argument where people say that can't be a coincidence. Those things, numbers are so tightly put together that we need to explain. We need to bring in God to explain why the universe is like that. So that's an example of saying the universe appears to be a remarkable and a very unlikely place. And you can either just treat that as a coincidence, or you can say there has to be an explanation for it, and then you either bring in a person or you bring in values. So the question, would it make any difference? I mean, there's two ways of answering that. So if you're a theist and you became convinced of my view, then that should change the way you live, because certain things that you thought you had one kind of relationship with God, and whatever kind of relationship you're going to have, it's not going to be that one. And also, my view has implications about what might happen after death and so on. So if you're attached to a particular religious tradition, then you need to rethink it pretty radically. But I also think if someone converted to my view from being an atheist, as far as I can tell, this is a hypothetical claim because I haven't managed to convert anybody. But if somebody did, then I think it would make a difference, just because... And this is, I mean, this goes back to answering John's worry and Bev's worry. It does seem to me that just discovering that the universe exists for a particular reason would change the way you thought about some questions in your life, right? So discovering what the universe is like, exploring the questions in cosmology that give rise to questions about the existence of God, exploring whether there's life elsewhere in the universe, I think becomes more pressing, because if the universe is not about us, it could be about somebody else, and it would be good to find them. I mean, that would be fun anyway, but this gives a new... So it gives a new impetus to certain kinds of things, and if you got more knowledge about the values, you might think a better life is one that reflects those values, whatever they might be.
It's a gentleman in the blue jacket.
Confused, actually, so bear with me for a moment. I think your starting point is very interesting, that the universe isn't about us, and there are models of how the universe can evolve mathematically. There is a purpose. It does begin, it does expand, and it does dissipate eventually. And we are just a side product of it, and we create our own morals and our own ethics based upon our social being and social understanding to some extent. So I see this beautiful dichotomy between the two. but I don't understand, why are you bringing in this thing called God or these labels that are attached? I mean, you mentioned that it could be some sort of an aesthetic or mathematics or beauty of this type which goes into the equations that can describe it. Which is okay, no? I mean, that's a good thing. So purpose is a good word to be used to some extent, because the equations do have purpose and they do evolve accordingly.
So one thing I would want to say is I think that, I mean, in some ways the philosophical question that I'm particularly interested in is a kind of, the further question that you ask once you've, suppose you've done your maths and your physics and you've got this picture of what the universe is like, right? And you say it's governed by these equations and it's moving in this particular kind of direction. So in some sense, philosophers have nothing to say about that except, wow, that's really cool. And, you know, that's really worth knowing. But the philosophical question is, why is there a universe that is governed by those laws rather than there being a universe that's governed by other laws or a universe that's not governed by mathematical laws at all? So it's not, I mean, it seems obvious to us, but it's not a priori obvious that a universe has to be governed by laws that can be expressed mathematically. That was a pretty big thing that people discovered. And so then the claim is you've got all these possible universes that could, possible worlds, possible ways the universe could have been, or the multiverse could have been, or the actual reality could have been. And can we say anything intelligible about why it's this one governed by these laws which behaves like this, rather than this other one that's completely chaotic, or this other one that's governed by other laws? And the answer that the purposivist gives is that there is something transcendently special about the laws that govern that universe, or some other feature of that universe. So that if you were standing outside and looking at all the different possible worlds, the different possible actualities, you would see that one as being special. So it's not just it seems special to the people who are in it, it would seem special to someone who was standing outside it. And that therefore, that's why either a person did choose it, or the very fact that those are the most special laws has somehow brought it about that is the one that's actual. And the reason for entertaining those sort of thoughts is that otherwise you just have to say, look, the universe is governed by these extraordinary mathematical laws that we are capable of understanding, and that's just the way it is. There's no explanation for that. There's no reason for it. It could have been, you know, any number of other ways, and it just happens to be that way. And some people are happy to say, okay, fair enough. Yeah, that's, you know, it had to be some way, it happens to be this way, it seems special to us because we're in it, but there's nothing transcendently special about it. But a lot of people are not satisfied with that, and they feel the pull of thinking there has to be a story, not just about how the universe works, but about why we're in a universe that works like that. And then the claim is, knowing that that's not just how the universe works, but why it exists, is supposed to transform your life in, or give a certain richness to the values, or a source of normativity. And then exactly how that's going to play out depends a lot on how you fill out the story of what the values are.
Yeah. Can I just chip in? I'm sorry to strike a skeptical note, but that seems to me doesn't get anywhere near explaining why it exists. Stephen Hawking, in that book, The Brief History of Time, says towards the end, perhaps if we find a grand theory of everything, the theory will be so powerful that it brings about its own existence and the existence. Well, you know, mathematical equations can't bring about the existence of anything. Nor can properties of like goodness bring about their own existence. So it seems to me all this stuff about elegant mathematical equations is really a red herring. We don't have a power that can actualize, accomplish anything. At least the traditional god is supposed to have power, as well as various other properties, will, intellect, so he can have purposes, he can have properties, God can have various kinds of mental properties, and has the power to initiate or bring things into existence. These theoretical properties don't seem to me to have any power. They're exactly as you were saying. They're just equations.
The axiarchic story is an odd story. I don't think it's that it's not completely unfamiliar. So if you said why is it raining, and you say, oh, it's because we're in Britain. If you say, why is it either raining or not raining, or why is it not the case that it's both raining and not raining, then you say, well, that's a logical necessity. It has to be either one or the other, and it can't be both, because you can't have true contradictions. And that's a different kind of case, but that's a case where a logical principle explains something about the universe that we live in, or something that exists. Now, it's a leap to say that there might be these axiarchic principles where goodness brings things into existence. But, I mean, the thing the axiarchist is going to say is you've got basically three possible explanations on the table. The existence of a universe that has all these astonishing properties is just a brute fact. There is no explanation for it. Or you say, there is a person who chose to create a universe like this, in which case you need a story about why that person exists. But someone's going to say, you know, why is it that God exists? I'm not going to accept that. Or you have some other way in which it isn't a coincidence. And to some extent, I mean, one thing axiarchists will say is they say, look, we have no idea how this works. Okay. But what we're committed to saying is that it can't be a coincidence that the universe that exists is one that has these beautiful properties. So that either it's a person or it's a principle or it's something like logic, but there has to be, you know, it's either that or accepting that there is just no explanation for something that seems so remarkable.
I'm going to try to squeeze in two further questions, and if we can take them in succession, that would be great. If you've got a question, then please raise your hand. There's a lady right in the middle. And we'll take one from the corner in the back next. So we'll take two in a row.
Do you, first of all, I just wanted to ask, do you believe that the universe is infinite? Because if you believe the universe is infinite, then I don't understand how we can see ourselves beyond it in any sort of way, how we can transcend it. And secondly, I just wanted to address the idea that when you're talking about religion, I thought perhaps the only way to understand the purpose of religion is to begin by understanding and considering through all the philosophies that they all hold in common fundamentally. Because I don't really understand how we can transcend something that's infinite. And if human beings can only use their brain 2%, how can we understand the 100% of what's happening?
Thank you.
Thank you.
And at the back, if you just wait for the mic, then you'll be on the podcast.
So I want to go back to like the very beginning. I think you mentioned, you can correct me, of course, that atheists don't necessarily have a purpose, since they don't believe in anything, and they don't necessarily have morals because they don't really believe in anything. And I would actually disagree. I would say that not believing in a god, or like there is no need to believe in a god to have a purpose or morals. How do you feel about that?
Great, thanks. I'll invite anybody on the panel to jump into either of those two questions, Tim.
So on the question of infinity, So the short answer is don't ask me, I'm a philosopher. I don't know. I don't know whether the universe is infinite in the sense of being spatio-temporally infinite. And it might be. But the sense of transcending it that I'm playing with is where you say, well, this is the universe that we're in, and it might be just really, really big, or it might be infinitely big, but we can imagine other ways the universe could have been. We can imagine, you know, there is this universe that's infinite. There could have been, in a sort of logical sense of could, a finite universe. Right? So if you discover that the universe is infinite, you can say, why is it infinite? There could have existed instead a finite universe, or there could have existed instead a universe that was governed by completely different laws. So that's the sense of transcending, that you have these different, what philosophers call possible worlds, so the different ways the universe could have been, and some of them are infinite and some of them are finite, and the question we want to ask is, why is it this one that exists rather than one of the others? On the question of what the religions have in common, so one of the arguments I think for my view is that it is problematic for the theist to explain why there are different religions. Right, this is a very, very old objection to theism, because if there's a God who cares about us and God has a message and it's directed by towards us, then it is a bit of a puzzle why people hear such different messages from God. Whereas on my view, you could say, well, look, there's this message being somehow conveyed to the universe, or these values that are lying behind the universe, and people misunderstand that because they interpret it in a way that sort of bigs themselves up, or makes this sort of self-aggrandizing. So they interpret God's love for creation as being about them, and so on. So I think the plurality of religions could be an argument for my view.
Question about whether atheists can be good people, clearly and obviously they can, and obviously theists can often be very bad people. Now the question is more about the status of that goodness and badness. Is it just something we create, or our culture creates, or is it something more fundamental and objective against which we measure our own progress, or the progress of our culture? If it's something objective, then I think the next move will be to suggest that there must be something in the nature of reality which explains that. And that, I think that's the best argument for theism. Of course, the way it's perceived will vary from culture to culture, and it's hardly surprising that there are lots of different interpretations of God and so on, depending on history and geography and so on. But on the religious view, perhaps they're all reaching towards the same ultimate source of value, despite the tension. Sorry.
Although I do wonder and I worry, as a philosopher of religion who has perhaps a difficult relationship with her own subject, whether starting with belief and argument is ever going to be the best way of getting into what it is people think they're doing religiously, that there's something about, and this is where I felt very close to some of the things you were saying, that there's something about an attempt to live well in the world that's driving religious practice. And I don't think philosophers think enough about religious practice and what people think they're trying to do when they align themselves with sets of belief. Because I don't actually think, frankly, belief a lot of the time plays much of a part. And I say that in a positive way. I actually think sometimes we're far too head-based about quite what is going on with religious perspectives. And I'm not saying that as a way of critiquing religion. Quite the contrary. I think there's something incredibly important about how people try to find ways of living in the world, and a world that is or has features that call forth the kind of religious perspective, the attempt to bind ourselves again to the world or to other people or to make sense of things. But I think it's a lived thing, and I slightly worry that by adopting the language of theism, atheism, in this very precise philosophical sense, we're perhaps missing that.
Good. Well, let's move us on to these kinds of issues, because we've talked a lot about whether we can have purpose in the universe without God, but there's the opposite kind of question as well, whether we can have God or religion without purpose. Can we make sense of religion or a kind of theistic worldview that doesn't involve a sense of cosmic purpose? And Bev, would you suggest that perhaps we can?
Yeah, I mean, just building on what I've just said, really, that I'm not convinced that religion is ultimately about belief. As I say, I think it's actually much more to do with practice. And it strikes me that if you start thinking about religious practice, then it's not obviously ends orientated. It's something about how you establish frameworks for living or patterns of behaviour, or you use stories, or you engage with the world perhaps on a much more felt experience. And then, so I suppose when we go back to suffering, I think it's quite curious that often suffering is the thing that makes people want to engage religiously. So I'm not so sure that it's always the thing that knocks down religious positioning, that there's perhaps something that calls forth something. Again, I find language quite difficult to talk about with these things. I'm not sure how well we can pin them down, but you know, there seems to be something about when we experience the kind of existential problems that were pointed to, you know, the actual experience of being a mutable, changing human being, that we try to engage with that, and that's perhaps the driver of religion rather a set of beliefs about the nature of the universe. But
personally, I totally agree with that, and although Tim, I think, starts from the moral end, so that's a point of agreement. It's a very theoretical, abstract moral end. It's about the various possible meta-ethical options, whereas I think we need to start understanding the form of life which gives meaning and sense to religion first. That's got to come first. It's rather as if, it's not a matter of, I mean, Tim Elliott said, well, I'm doing philosophy, so this is obviously an academic book. But I think the reply to that is there are many ways of philosophizing, and it's by no means clear that philosophers need to confine themselves only to the resources of the analytic intellect. There are all sorts of other faculties and capacities we have as human beings: emotional, imaginative, empathetic, literary, poetic, and this is what I call humane philosophizing. And I'm convinced that this is the way to go if we're to understand what it is to adopt a religious form of life or to reject it. We simply can't adjudicate at the level of abstract metaphysics and meta-ethics. So, yeah, sorry. That's said enough. Yeah.
But I think that's where the puncturing of self-aggrandisement, to me, is a fundamental core religious concern. It seems to me that all the faiths in various ways have strands within them that try to do precisely that. You know, the idea that you should kind of challenge the notion that somehow you and your desires are the kind of still point of a turning world. I think that comes across very strongly, and I felt that was where, for me, a lot of those kind of religious drivers are to be found. You know, the desire to actually say human beings aren't all that matters. You know, actually having that kind of sense that, and we're told all the time that us and our desires, and you know, even just down to pillaging the earth of resources in the name of what's good for human beings, you know, I think that's a really important message. And it strikes me that within religious story there is often that desire to put yourself in a different place and adopt a different perspective. So again, I thought there's some really, really useful sources there.
Could I just put an opposing view to something that John and Bev said? So in response to the problem of evil, you both mentioned that suffering is a way that religion gets started rather than a kind of decisive objection. But it is consistent with somebody's view, if they believe that the problem of evil really is a problem, to accept that from a psychological point of view, that is often a cause of people's belief in God, suffering. But nonetheless, the fact of suffering is inconsistent with this God which has certain traditional properties.
But isn't this the problem with a certain type of philosophy of religion, where if you say, you know, well, perhaps suffering might be a way in which people... It's not... I'm not trying to make a general claim. You know, I'm not going to say... I'm not, definitely not going to sit here and say, that's the reason evil's here. I'm really not going to. I think my view would be more, this is the world we find ourselves in, and how do we engage with it? And I don't, I suppose from that perspective, I don't think suffering is the knockdown argument philosophers think it is, which isn't to say that it isn't a problem.
Right, so in a way it isn't a move within that same debate of the problem of evil, but a rather sort of call to have a different conversation about religion.
Yeah,
I see.
And of course, Tim is a consequentialist. I think that's the kind of virus that infects some of his reasoning. So he's in effect saying that the cosmos ought to have, if there's a benevolent God, ought to have a greater balance of good than it does. Although I'm not quite sure how that squares with the view he was presenting a few minutes ago, where the axiarchic view, where goodness somehow has the power to bring things into existence. I suppose, in a way, that would be the picture you're presenting is a consequentialist position, where it has the power to bring the overall balance of good into existence. But there could be some unfortunate casualties along the way, and that includes us, not too good on this planet. But that, I mean, going back to what Bev was saying, that doesn't seem to me to connect with anything like a religious way of life. It doesn't, as it were, connect with what makes people religious, with what drives the religious impulse, with the human search for meaning and value. It's just an alleged abstract property which is supposed to be able to do things at the purely theoretical level. So I'm back with the puzzlement as to how this really connects with the phenomenon of religion as a human form of life.
Right, so I suppose what I want to say is, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you both say. I mean, I do think, you know, there's a lot to religion other than beliefs about the nature of the cosmos. But it's also true that one of the things that is an element of religious life, it might be not be the most important element, it might not be the thing that brings people to religion, but it is, for a lot of people, a part of having a religious life, being in a religious community, having a religious view of the world, is having a story about the nature of the universe and why the universe exists and our place in it. And one thing you might say, if you're not as interested in that sort of the theoretical metaphysical question and you're more interested in the lived question, is that for some people the package that is traditional theism gets in the way of them living life or making sense of the world as they find it, because some people do find consolation in theism when they are confronted by suffering and their own suffering and the suffering of loved ones and things, but other people just lose their faith, right? And that's the expression that we have. They think, you know, I just can't believe that this could happen in a world that was created by a loving God. And if the only options you have on the table are traditional theism and atheism, then you have to throw a lot of things out that I think you don't have to throw out, where you can say, well, you can still have, you know, you can have a personal God, possibly, if it's that, if it's an anthropocentric theism, and you can say that the God is putting value into the world, but it's at a level in a way, and in a way that doesn't connect directly with our lives. And that might be easier existentially for a lot of people than thinking this is being done by somebody who really particularly cares about me and this is consistent with them loving me and so on. So I don't think it's necessarily, I don't think that there's a complete disconnect. And
but there's still a problem, I think, about how we come in. I mean, one of the ways of responding to the call of the good on the traditional religious view is that we can somehow bring ourselves into relationship with the good. Now, on your view, there's no question of bringing ourselves into relationship with God or whatever it is you believe in, because that being has no interest in us. So it's a blank wall.
Well, it's a different kind of relationship, I suppose. It's a one-sided relationship.
I want to bring in our audience again now. So if you didn't manage to ask a question last time, now's your chance. We're going to take three questions in a row again, if we can. So there's a question here, a question just in the second row, and in the back. I'm already pointing, sorry. The white T-shirt.
If we were to come across your God or being that doesn't particularly give much attention to us, should we worship them?
Yeah, thanks. And let's go to the next question, and we'll take them in order. So feel free, panelists, to jump in.
This problem of pain. Isn't talking in terms of good, bad, and so on, anthropomorphizing an entity which is beyond our comprehension in the first place? That if there is a God, then this God is so far, which created the universe, then anything that does create the universe is beyond our comprehension to understand in the first place, and that our petty terminology of good, bad, indifferent, whatever, is like an ant crawling across a table and coming across an IBM supercomputer. It might be aware that there's an object in front of it, but to have the comprehension about what this computer is beyond their mindset completely.
Thank you.
So I'm not sure who put this theory forward, but I think it's called The Watchmaker, and it's about a God that created a purposeless world, universe, and in it, the God just put the rules such as gravity, and then he let things play the way they did. And we came to be, it might be an accident, it might have been one of many possible. My question is, would this theory fall under your AP or not? And if not, what differentiates it from it?
Okay.
So if I can, I might start with the first question. So worship is a really interesting question for me. I think there are some reasons, and this goes back to conversation with John. There are some reasons you might have for worshipping a God who did care about you, which aren't going to apply. So you're not going to enter into a reciprocal relationship. You're not going to get anything out of it. But on the other hand, I think there are reasons for worshipping and senses of worship if you think of it as a certain kind of study, contemplation, or possibly gratitude in a certain sense. All of those kinds of attitudes, it seems to me, do make sense. Imitation is another thing that goes along with worship that might make sense in relation to this kind of God. So it does seem to me that to turn it around. It would be odd, I think, to discover that there was such a God and just be uninterested and sort of unimpressed and say, well, you know, what's that got to do with me? And I think, you know, maybe worship is not quite the right word, but it's not clear to me that it's the wrong word. And on the last point, I mean, I think the watchmaker view is, I mean, that could be an example of it. That could be something that would fit under my view, that what God is interested in is, you know, especially if it's a universe that has unpredictable laws, you might be creating it to see how it's going to turn out. Mm. Or because you think that what will turn out will be a beautiful or valuable or glorious kind of pattern. And then, in some sense, you're interested in the particular things that emerge within it, but in a sort of aesthetic or scientific kind of way rather than a personal way. And that would be an instance of...
Is the second question about the incomprehensibility of God, I think that's very important, and that actually is a completely mainstream theism. It's in Aquinas and Augustine. The God is infinite, incomprehensible to the human mind. So the religious encounter is an encounter of the finite with the infinite. And one thing I do object to about Tim's picture of theism is he presents a very naive version. At one point in the book, he suggests that theists really rather hanker for a medieval cosmos, a finite medieval cosmos. And they would, you know, if we could discover that the Earth was at the center, that would kind of reassure them. Well, perhaps I misread that bit, but I don't know any theist who would like to go back, any serious reflective theist who would like to go back to the medieval cosmos. On the contrary, since the early modern period, it's been absolute standard position that God, Descartes, Leibniz, and many others say that God pours forth his infinite power in creation. And so it's not a cozy, theism isn't a cozy little idea that it's just the Earth at the centre.
I mean, I've been sitting here looking at a quote from the desert writer Ed Abbey, and he's sort of reflecting on the desert in front of him, and he says, not God, the term seems insufficient, but something unnameable and more beautiful and far greater and more terrible. And I think the problem with philosophers is that we do like to think we can pin this stuff down, and perhaps it's important to have that not knowing aspect.
I might just say a couple of things. So first of all, that wasn't the impression I meant to capture in that chapter. I do think that theists of a benevolent theist kind can and should be perfectly happy with a very large, glorious kind of universe. Though I do think. I do think the incomprehensibility of God should push somebody to saying, if they are going to spell out their philosophical view, then if you really think God is incomprehensible, then you should say you're a theist and you're agnostic between benevolent theism and anthropocentric theism. Because, I mean, it does seem to me there's something... Maybe not. Yeah, there's something philosophically odd about people who want to say, look, we know God is completely incomprehensible, we know nothing about God's purposes, but we know that God is interested in us. And I think, so I do think, if you really think God is incomprehensible, then you should be an agnostic theist in the sense of being agnostic between what I call benevolent theism and what I call an anthropocentric.
Well, Descartes uses quite a nice metaphor that I think that God is like the mountain, which you can't comprehend. In Latin, you can't put your arms around it, but you may be able to reach towards and perhaps even touch it. So the finite clearly can't comprehend the infinite. That would be a contradiction. But the religious tradition says that we can have intimations of the infinite, and one of those intimations is the moral intimations that you and I agree we have. Those intuitions about objective value and meaning, which we didn't create. So I think there's a strongly theistic strand there, which I think you hold. So anyway, that was just a point about comprehensible.
Am I right in thinking that both of you, John and Tim, would like to claim the sentiment in the quotation that Bev read out? Would you identify that as theism, that this kind of terrible but some kind of purpose? Because in the broad notion of theism that you were talking about, that ought to kind of map onto that. But this also seems like AP.
I suppose what I want to say is, suppose we grant that there's an experience there, the question is going to be, what is the reality that you're experiencing? And it seems to me, if when people express themselves in that sort of way and they emphasise the incomprehensibility and the vastness and the enormousness of God, that it's not the experience that's helping you to differentiate between the benevolent theist and the anthropocentric theist story. The experience is just of something that's vast and transcendent, and then what you're bringing to it is something else, which you use to interpret that experience in a particular way rather than another way. And you're interpreting it within a particular religious tradition where the story about God is that God is such and such. But you could just as well take that experience and interpret it in terms of my story if you had a religious tradition that had my story, which hasn't quite got going yet.
Well, I think this is a good time to draw our discussion to a close. So let's thank Tim for, first of all, writing such a thought-provoking book, and for the rest of our panelists.